Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. And welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Robert Olin Butler, whose new novel is Perfume River. We'll also hear from Michael Allen Zell, whose new book in the Bobby Delery series is Law and Desire. Robert Olin Butler is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of one of my very favorite books, A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain, which brought to vivid life the Eastern New Orleans Vietnamese community of Versailles. Much of his work, 16 novels, 6 short story collections, has been set in Louisiana, where he lived while teaching at McNeese State University. Today, we'll be talking about his new novel, set in Florida, called Perfume River. Bob Butler, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. It's great to talk to you.
Oh, you've written so much about the Vietnam War, Bob.
Yeah.
And yet, it seems to me that this book was there waiting all along for you to write it, as if this much time had to pass before you could gain the perspective that emerges in this novel.
Yes, it's smart of you to say that, because when people ask me how long I've been writing this book, I say, well, probably 60 years, because I had to process Vietnam all the way into the stage of my life, but it also looks back to, you know, my dad was a World War II veteran, and this is by no means autobiographical, and that my relationship with my father had some fundamental differences from this. You know, there's a father and a figure in the book, too. It looks back not just to Vietnam, this book, but also to World War II, and within his memory, even to World War I, and we look forward towards the wars of the current era. Wars and families have always been intimately intertwined, and the book is really focused on the boomer generation, but it's about that kind of enduring reality.
Now, this family, I have to say, had New Orleans roots, so thank you. And your main character, Robert Quinlan, is a 70-year-old Vietnam vet, and his brother, Jimmy, was a conscientious objector who moved to Canada. And their father, as you say, is a World War II vet. And so these three men are all bound together in conflict and in love, you know, which is such a volatile combination often.
Indeed. Yeah, and the brother, of course, takes a different path to Canada, and we follow him very carefully as well. But the family split down the middle at some point. And yet, the factors underlying all of that and the connections and disconnections beneath it were never really quite as the people understood them to be. As you know, Susan, I've almost always written in first person, and this book is written in the third person, because I needed to be able to slip in a narrative omniscient persona to clarify the ways in which the characters were misconnecting, not only with each other, but with themselves. And the book's about the fragility of language, about how words can slip just sideways without even being noticed and create perceptions and misperceptions that last a lifetime.
And there's another Bob, a man Robert meets in a restaurant in this book. And Robert wrongly assumes that Bob is a veteran, and Bob doesn't speak very much. So there is that kind of sense of the assumptions we make about the people we meet.
Yes. And we do get inside Bob very deeply, but it's all kept private. And yet, even at his center, he has a man who was silent, utterly silent, his own father, who was a Vietnam vet. And Robert, the main character, does mistake him. And this is a homeless man. I don't know if we've mentioned that.
Right.
He mistakes him not only for a veteran, but for a Vietnam veteran at first glance. And yet, even though he wasn't, he missed that war by a generation, the homeless man. His father was there. And so Bob is also profoundly affected by that war in quite a different way.
Now, there's one scene in this book that I love, Bob. I love it so much because I can see it so vividly in my mind's eye. And it happens during Robert's service in Vietnam, and there's a raid. And he goes out into the night, and he realizes that he's in danger, and he steps inside a tree. Mm-hmm. It's such an amazing moment. As you read it, you can almost feel that tree closing around you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a banyan tree, actually, which is an interesting tree. Every banyan tree is striking in its visualness, and it's enormous and has a kind of multiple root system. But every banyan tree began by killing another tree.
Uh-huh.
It has strangler roots that come up, and it takes over another tree and then it eventually engulfs it. But yes, he goes into that tree and emerges at one point in the middle of the night to do what one does in wars by reflex, to shoot and to kill. And there's some ambiguity and unanswered questions about all that that haunt him forever.
And then later we see that he has that big oak tree in his Florida backyard.
Yeah. Yeah.
And sometimes he goes out to commune with it, only this time he is encircling the tree.
Yep.
Which I loved. It's such a beautiful, beautiful symmetry.
Thank you.
Now, one thing you've always written about so beautifully is the urgency of desire.
Mm-hmm.
And in this book, it seems to me, you turn that attention to old love,
mm-hmm.
to the long marriage,
mm-hmm.
to the inevitable compromises and rewards that come with such a relationship.
Yep.
So this, too, I think, is maybe not a book you could have written a long time ago.
No, not at all. It isn't. You know, I've been through quite a few marriages, and the irony, of course, is that I've finally found the most extraordinary soulmate, and my own personal circumstances are somewhat different now as a result of that, because she's quite a bit younger than me, but I understand that other kind of marriage very well. And Robert and Darla are both professors together. They work, they have offices in the house, they have a kind of deeply personal communication, mode of interacting, a deep familiarity. But in a way, the familiarity is so intimate that familiarity is taken over for actual connection.
I love that moment when Darla looks at him and goes, I haven't been seeing him clearly. You know, every woman has that moment at some point.
Yeah, exactly.
And the women in this book are so interesting. I mean, Darla is nothing if not competent and in charge.
Yeah.
She's a serious scholar. She's an art historian who is writing about war monuments.
Yes. And finds, I think, even a little to her surprise, a deep sort of empathy with the, more than war monuments, these war monuments you see in the town square of so many small southern towns.
It's, yes.
Done up in the late 19th century, usually, by the local Daughters of the Confederacy. And every one of them was locally done, so there's this extraordinary invented commentary written on most of these monuments that were done by a local ladies' club. And indeed, the monument that Darla examines and deconstructs in the book sits just 9 miles from my house up in Monticello, Florida.
Oh, that was so fascinating. And then there's Robert's mother, who's difficult to say the least. I mean, this is a woman who's got two sons with differing viewpoints, is faced with losing her husband at some point. And she's a piece of work. She has her own drama to unfold.
She is. And again, her focus, her war has always been, she has this kind of image of family and how it's supposed to interact and how the level of commitment, even the forms of commitment that is supposed to be there. And she just never can quite bring them all into that. And of course, she faces a serious issues. And again, the war, various wars, profoundly affect her capacity of, I mean, the kind of family she envisions, the image of it, which is, you know, the classic 50s image of a family. She might well have accomplished it except for war. I mean, her husband carries secrets with him from his war, World War II, in a deep silence about it. One of her sons just exiles himself, not only from America, but from their family in reaction to the Vietnam War. One of them goes off to war, and in terms of the family, never really accomplished what he thought he was accomplishing. It's a very complicated thing. There is one scene toward the end of the book where we get inside Peggy in a way that I think might surprise people.
Yes, it's really wonderful. Now, to read this book, I think, is to see what time can do, what wounds endure, what wounds can heal, mm-hmm. what wisdom comes as a result. I'm curious if this felt different to you as you were writing it.
Different from my other books?
Yes.
Absolutely. Different and yet a fulfillment of. I mean,
right.
the issues I've been talking about were in the up. And by the way, there's a lot of New Orleans in this book. Isn't
oh, yes.
Their background is there. But it clearly is an aesthetic descendant of Goodson from a Strange Mountain, where the characters, all of them were exiled. They were shaped by one country and exiled into another. You know, Vietnamese exiles living in New Orleans, in the New Orleans area, mostly southern Louisiana. And they had to reinvent themselves in this new country and yet come to terms with what they were as they were shaped in Vietnam. That is broadly true of Perfume River as well. Though it's about Americans in America, they too were shaped in various ways. They didn't have to go to be shaped. It was a TV war. It was a war of your relatives who brought it with them in one way or another. But the central people, the boomer generation, we too were shaped by that war. And now we are exiled into another country, a country of incipient old age and intimations of mortality. You know, and that is a different country to live in.
And
it does force you to reassess who you are. And these characters in that new country also come to terms with the fact that who they are has to do with who they were and what they did and where they were. And for this generation, it certainly goes back to Vietnam and also, by extension, other wars as well.
Well, this is one Perfume River you can cross over and be carried along by. We've been talking with Robert Olin Butler, whose thought-provoking new novel is Perfume River. You can meet him Tuesday, October 11th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Bob, thank you so much.
It's been a delight talking with you, Susan, as always.
I can't remember anything. Can't tell if this is true or dream. Deep down inside, I feel the scream. This terrible silence stops in there. Now that the war is through with me, I'm waking up, I cannot see that there's not much left in me. Nothing is real but pain.
Michael Allen Zell is a bookseller. He's the manager of Crescent City Books and a playwright, author of What Do You Say to a Shadow, as well as a novelist. He's the author of Errata and The Oblivion Atlas. Recently, he's turned to writing crime fiction. His first novel in the Bobby Delery series, about a Tulane criminologist returned to New Orleans post-Katrina, was Run, Baby, Run. His second, just out, is Law and Desire. So, Michael Allen Zell, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan.
I'm so happy to see Bobby Delery again. I enjoyed this book so much, and we learn a good bit more about him in this outing. So tell us a little bit about Bobby.
In the first book, Delery had just returned to New Orleans after being away most of his life. And in the second book, he runs into someone who starts to enlighten him on what happened to his family, who he didn't think were in New Orleans any longer. So the book is essentially set up as parallel stories. One of those is Delery's search for his two brothers, and the other is a councilperson who has an unorthodox way of fundraising because he wants to be mayor. So eventually these come to meet.
And you're plugging Bobby a little more deeply into his own New Orleans history, as well as the larger history of the city.
Right. He's a criminologist, so you get a little taste of that, but this is more kind of him on the street and meeting more people and interacting. He's essentially the lens for all the readers to follow.
These streets are recognizable streets to people who live in New Orleans. You have two important landmarks in this novel, the Club Desire and the Capri Motel, and Art Imitating Life. Some things happened during the writing of it that were kind of interesting.
You know, I expected that Club Desire would be demolished by the time the book came out. That happened about a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have any idea that Capri Motel was going to come down, although I saw how quickly Tulane Avenue was changing, so that seemed like a good place, and a notorious seedy motel seemed perfect for it. The Club Desire, even though it sounds like it's some sort of seedy club in its own right, was actually, although not really known by people at all, because I don't think there's much documentation of it, was a club similar to the Dewdrop Inn, but downriver, whereas you had people like Deacon John, Fats Domino, Billie Holiday, Ray Charles, This was the showcase club of a neighborhood. So this is the Upper Ninth Ward back near the Florida Canal. But not just that club. It was essentially an area kind of like Frenchman Street, mm-hmm. full of clubs. And because it was in a neighborhood, a lot of businesses as well. So I felt with this whole series and the impetus in writing these was that in a changing city that someone needed to bear witness, since each of these books takes place in the previous year. So this one's New Orleans 2015. I didn't expect at all that the two key fictional locations in the book would be gone by the time the book started.
That's weird, isn't it?
It is weird.
It's very
yeah.
weird.
Yeah.
See, I don't think Club Desire sounds seedy. I think it sounds great.
it kind of sounds like it could be on Bourbon Street.
Yeah, it could go either way,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
But also, you have contemporary landmarks in this that are recognizable to anybody. You know, Euclid Records, the bridge in the park in Bywater. People are going to know this is their New Orleans.
Right.
And that seems really important to you.
And it's focused. I mean, obviously, Tulane Avenue isn't in their parts of the city that aren't, but a lot of the focus on the books is the 5th District Police area, but also the 9th Ward and a little bit of the 8th Ward, the river on back. So Delery himself lives near the river, but I think in the first book, it didn't go any further back than essentially about Claiborne, Robertson kind of area. So this is going back a little further near the Florida, but that helps too in that there can be some recurring characters. So Blue Shoes, who was kind of a mess in the first one, is turning his life around. And then Griot Sam, who's the voice of wisdom, he's showing up again. So that's something that will continue on through the books. You'll see, I guess, a through line through the books of not just Delery and Ella Smith as well, his girlfriend and someone who is pretty strong in her own right, but there'll be some other characters that may just pop up for a minute. I can tell you definitely in the next book after this, which is I'm working on now, there'll be some characters from Run Baby Run that will show up again that weren't in this one. So it's kind of fun to play with that.
I'll keep my fingers crossed for my favorites to show up again. There are some wonderful characters in this book, but there are some wonderful qualities of the city that I think are so interesting that are apparent in this book. Of course, the title, Law and Desire. You know, New Orleans is a place where desires have always come into conflict with law itself. And you have a lot of people who want to take the law into their own hands in this book.
Right. Well, and one reason, in fact, that I wanted the protagonist to be a criminologist is that he is somebody that would be interacting with NOPD, but also is a regular guy. And in some cases, the books won't really have a whole lot of NOPD involvement in to suggest that we're kind of on our own to mm-hmm. some extent. This book does because
yes.
law was, the title means a few things, everything yeah. from the metaphor to the streets to this and that. But there definitely is more of an introduction of some law enforcement in this one. Nelson Harrell was a fun character to write, the homicide detective.
He's a great character yeah. and he's a very kind character.
I felt that in the first book, that maybe there wasn't enough of a balance. All the officers that you saw were of one type, and I wanted somebody in there who was a good guy because I've met enough officers who are good guys.
Oh,
and
me too.
I felt like there should be a balance of that.
Well, and that's important when you're undertaking a series like this. And then you have a lot of person-to-person kindness in this book, which I think is New Orleans at its best. You know, that must have been fun for you to write.
It's just enjoyable in general. The historic research is great, especially in this Desire Street, Florida area, because I knew nothing about it going into it. And then when I found out more and more, it just stunned me. But ultimately, with the changing city, some of these buildings are disappearing. But in talking to people and seeing how people's lives are changed, and I think a rapidly changing city, not just rapidly for New Orleans itself, but in general, I wouldn't have even pictured a year ago how much Tulane Avenue would have changed at this time. And I thought a year ago when I wrote this that was already starting to happen, but it's going on really quickly. And in fact, I thought that would be an area to focus on because in 5 years, it might not at all be the same, and it's quicker than that, in mm-hmm. fact. So,
well, one of the things that always interests me when you're writing a series like this is, you know, the plan for the future. You know, you're always mid-thing, you know, right now, you're looking back on a book you finished quite some time ago. You're writing another book. And I imagine when you walk around the city, I mean, not to go all woo-woo on you or whatever, but, you know, I imagine you must see it in a kind of particular way, a kind of blend of past and present.
You know, what I find interesting is reading the news just about every day is how many elements that I've written, either that I think are not far-fetched, but seem like things that would reasonably happen in New Orleans that do happen.
Yes.
And that always seems a little odd. I mean, there's, in this case, there is a double carjacking that happens in the middle of the day in an obvious spot. And it seemed to me like this is not the most likely spot where this might occur. But at the same time, I could see it. And it happened a few months after that. A double carjacking right in that area on Press Street. So that was stunning. But it's, in writing these, I guess the books that I was doing before were so much more, even though they were set in New Orleans, were so much more esoteric and more inward. And where these are, I guess the best way I would put it is they're still of the head, but it's head, heart, and hand. Mm-hmm. So you get a certain artistic level, but you also feel the beating heart of the city, and there's the hand is the tactile quality of it that exists as well. So it gives me more appreciation for the city. So yeah, when I'm out walking around or when I hear something in the news, there was an event, a shooting, as in an event that happened yesterday at school on Galvez, and I knew exactly where that was. So I know my city better. Mm-hmm. So in knowing a city of neighborhoods, it makes you appreciate that more.
Definitely. I mean, just when you think fiction is jaw-dropping, you listen to the news, and it's just, I know that scene you're talking about, the carjacking scene in the book, was if you're a New Orleanian, it just makes you stop and think.
Well, and you notice in the book, the new people to the city responded in one way, and the old-timer responded in another way.
No.
And in that neighborhood, you don't know who you might run into.
You've also got some fascinating bicyclists in this book.
There are.
I enjoyed them enormously.
Did you?
Yes, I did.
Did you? There's a bike gang that figures into this. I feel
We should say not a biker gang, but a bike gang.
Bicyclist gang, yes. So everything from, I guess what I would call regular bike, but tall bikes, low riders, pretty much you name it. And this is a bike gang that becomes vigilantes of a sort, and they get actively involved.
I know. I like this character, Window, I think.
You like Window?
Who always enters in through a window.
Because he enters in through a window.
Fantastic. So is this where your heart is now? Is this where, when you're talking about head, heart, and hand and the kind of work you're doing, is this where your heart is? It feels full-hearted to me.
I think so. Yeah. Bill Lavender commented the same way that you are. These are published by Lavender Inc. He commented the same way that this one felt like voice was stronger. Like nothing against the first book, but that this just seemed more realized and there was more me in it. And I think with Run Baby Run, that was a new, where I considered that is this genre and I need to write this genre and can I do this? It was a test of sorts. Mm-hmm. Whereas by the second book, now I feel more comfortable in it and I feel I can insert more of the previous sort of either style-wise or make it more personal.
It was so much fun. You know, it was fun and not fun in the way
a little gritty, a little humor.
Yeah. You're right, lot of humor and a lot of your humor, which I think is so great. So
thank you.
Readers are in for a treat. We've been talking with Michael Alanzel, whose second novel in the Bobby Delery series is Law and Desire. You can meet him Tuesday, October 4th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop and Friday, October 7th at 6 at Community Book Center. Or you can catch him at Crescent City Books, which has moved to a new location at 124 Barone Street. Michael, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
There's a moon over Bourbon Street tonight. I see faces as they pass beneath the pale lamplight. I've no choice but to follow that call. The bright lights, the people, and the moon and all.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guest, Michael Alanzel, reads from and signs his new novel in the Bobby Delery series, Law and Desire. That's Tuesday, October 4th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Christopher Romaguera reads from his work as well. Peyton Burgess, author of The Fry Pans Aren't Sufficing, is the featured reader in the 1718 reading series, Tuesday, October 4th at 7 at the Columns Hotel. Lee Collins and Courtney Nathan discuss Gus and Son, Parenting Through Illness, Help for Families When a Parent is Seriously Ill, Tuesday, October 4th at 6 at Octavia Books. There'll be an open mic poetry night Tuesday, October 4th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Errol Laborde reads from and signs Essential New Orleans, 15 Places We Love, Wednesday, October 5th at 6 at Octavia Books. Ethan Brown signs Murder in the Bayou, Who Killed the Women Known as the Jeff Davis Eight, Wednesday, October 5th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Laura Kelly, author of The Irish in New Orleans, discusses her work Wednesday, October 5th at 6 at St. Alphonse's Church. Jerry Strahan discusses and signs Lucky Dogs, From Bourbon Street to Beijing and Beyond, Thursday, October 6th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Alex Beard discusses and signs A Brush with Nature, Abstract Naturalism and the Painting of Life, Thursday, October 6th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Octavia Books Science Fiction Book Club discusses Set Against a Dark Background by Ian Banks, Saturday, October 8th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. The Women's National Book Association of New Orleans sponsors their annual National Reading Group Month celebration, Saturday, October 8th from 2 to 4 at the New Orleans Public Library Main Branch. At 2:30, local book club representatives talk about their groups, followed by a panel of authors featuring Christy Woodson Harvey, author of Lies and Other Acts of Love, Laura Mullen, author of Complicated Grief, Laura Naughton, author of The Jaguar Man, and Stephanie Story, author of Oil and Marble, a novel of Leonardo and Michelangelo. I'll be there to moderate. You be there too. Christy Woodson Harvey also appears Friday, October 7th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Nathan Wethington signs Invasion of the Bastard Cannibals and Other True Stories from a Southerner Beyond the Mason-Dixon Line, Sunday, October 9th at 1 at Barnes & Noble West Bank. Winston Groom discusses and signs his historical novel, El Paso, set during the Mexican Revolution, Monday, October 10th at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Robert Olin Butler, discusses and signs his new novel, Perfume River, Tuesday, October 11th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. And coming up this month, the Friends of the Jefferson Public Library conduct its semi-annual big book sale, Thursday, October 13th to Sunday, October 16th at the Pontchartrain Center, Williams Boulevard at the Lake in Kenner. Hours are 10 to 8 Thursday through Saturday and noon to 5 on Sunday. And for all you lovers of the Friends of the New Orleans Public Library book sale, it's back at Ladder Library's Carriage House. It's open Saturdays from 10 to 2. The Anne Rice Vampire Lestat Fan Club holds its 28th annual ball, Midnight in the Savage Garden of Blood and Evil, Friday, October 28th at the Republic, 828 South Peters. Doors open at 8. Check out arvlfc.com for more information and tickets. And the Louisiana Book Festival is coming up October 29th, all day, on the State Capitol grounds in Baton Rouge. Let's give a big shout out to the recipient of this year's Louisiana Writer Award, historian Christy Novella, who has taught at Tulane University for many years. She's the author of Intimate Enemies, The Two Worlds of the Baroness de Pontalba, as well as The Hitler Kiss, written with Radomir Lusa, Indecent Secrets, The Infamous Murray Murder Affair, and George Washington Carver, A Life. Vella will receive her award at 10 a.m., but the whole day is filled with readings, panel discussions, activities for the whole family, food, and music, and best of all, it's free. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.